So he basically spent a lot of time pulling together a whole lot of data from various sources in order to come up with an estimate of the total number of calories that would be in a human body and how those would be distributed around the body. So hint, hint, should one ever need to resort to cannibalism in order to survive, probably go for the thigh muscles first. Very nice, calorie rich.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire, writer at Science News and Society for Science and the Public. The natural world, the biological world we inhabit, it's a beautiful place. Blue skies, green trees, brown poo, yellow earwax. I mean, okay, not all aspects of it are great, but they are all interesting. Many people who love science have an especial love for guts and glory, and my friends, this podcast is for you. I am here with Erika Engelhaupt, freelance science writer and editor. She has been the online science editor at National Geographic and Science News, but what she's really into is the gory details. Her blog, Gory Details, explored the gross and ghoulish, and now she's got a book appropriately titled Gory Details, Adventures from the Dark Side of Science. Erika, it is so fun to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's so fun to talk to you and to share all of the gory details.
Oh, I'm so into it. I want to start first with what got you into gross stuff, because it's amazing and it's about teeth. Can you talk about the teeth?
Yeah, this is one of my childhood stories that I've told many people over the years, but you know, it's just one of those things, you know, when you're a kid, I hope that kids still get opportunities like this today. But, you know, I grew up in a world where kids could kind of roam free and where there was lots of room to play outside. And when I was a kid in Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, we lived in a little house that was up on a hill with 22 acres of land. And so every day I would come home on the school bus and my mom and my dog would be waiting for me, you know, down at the bottom of the hill. And one day we got there and there were these two kind of mountains of trash that had just kind of suddenly appeared at the end of our driveway. And they were you know, just assembled stuff. You know, we weren't even sure what it was. My mom and I go over and start like looking through this like mountain of stuff that somebody had just dumped on our land, basically, and start picking through it. And there were x-rays of teeth. And the best thing was that there were all of these plaster molds of teeth. So we figured out that someone had cleaned out a dentist's office and basically just like filled up a truck and driven it out to the middle of nowhere, which is where we lived, and dumped everything onto our property. So we just, it was the most fun thing that had ever happened to me at that point in my life. And my mom, who is wonderful for letting me, you know, keep x-rays of random strangers' teeth and all of these plaster molds. And I picked out all of course, the most snarly, you know, molds that had all of the like missing teeth and broken and crooked teeth. And I set them all up, you know, on my windowsill and had all of the like the little snaggle teeth set up. And there were just all kinds of, you know, little treasures in there. And it's kind of just a fun little thing that happened. But I always think about it, and I still have some of the little, you know, odds and ends from, this was probably when I was 6 or 7 years old. I still have a little necklace that I found in there. And I think what it means to me is that, you know, it can be just a pile of trash to someone, but you can find all kinds of interesting things in there. And I really appreciate that my parents weren't, you know, freaked out at the idea of letting their daughter, you know, look at a bunch of, you know, creepy x-rays of teeth and keep a bunch of weird souvenirs. and I guess that said something about my personality when I was a kid.
I have to say, it may say something about my personality as well. I would totally do that.
Yeah.
Also, for those who are not necessarily from the United States, yes, that is a thing that happens. Sometimes people will empty things out and just like get a truckload of trash that's just like a random truckload of trash and drive out to someone else's property and just drop it. That is a thing.
Yes. Yeah, so we had our own little landfill out of our property.
Joy.
You know, I mean, I guess I can't blame them for, you know, mistaking it for a dump. We did have also like some old cars that sat out and stuff like that. So it was a great place to be a kid. You want to be able to explore a property where there's like, you know, an old rusty Studebaker sitting somewhere.
I mean, there's no question of giant pile of childhood experiences. Yeah, the best childhood experiences are definitely lived within imminent danger of tetanus.
Like, absolutely. that describes now, my childhood.
Now, you know, you're kind of obsessed with gross stuff, as your book details, in sometimes kind of terrifying detail.
Yeah.
Why is it important to study gross stuff?
Well, you know, people ask me that a lot. Like, why would you want to even think about this stuff? That's, you know, like I write about things that are, you know, gross or scary or taboo. So I write about a lot of things that involve, you know, death or body parts or secretions. and so people say, well, why would you even want to think about that stuff? And for me, I guess the bigger point of it all is that I really like to make it easier for people to talk about things that are uncomfortable. And I think that by talking openly about things like death and our bodies, and questioning what we find disgusting and why, that we can learn a lot about ourselves and we can kind of get over some stuff. You know, I think we've got a lot of hangups, and I'd like to make it easier to talk about some of those things we're hung up about.
First, earwax. And then religion and world peace?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's all related, you know. I think, you know, you kind of do have to think about the language of disgust that we use, you know, even with world peace, okay. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but when you think about it, one of the ways that we distance ourselves from others or put others down is to paint them in terms of disgust, you know, to paint people as less than human or as dirty, or, you know, think about, you know, calling people filthy or, you know, immigrants get painted as, you know, bringing in diseases or being criminals, things that we're repulsed by. And so, you know, I think that if we recognize that kind of language of disgust, actually it can help lead to world peace, in the sense that if we think about, you know, why we're disgusted by certain things and recognize when we're using that disgust against other people, maybe it can actually make us better people.
Well, in the interest of diving in that much closer to world peace, we're going to start with death.
Perfect.
Which I think, you know, yeah, just dive in. So your book is kind of divided into sections that kind of are broad themes of things that mm-hmm. are just really uncomfortable. And death leads the way. And I was especially amused because I don't know if you ever saw, but there was an episode of Sex and the City. Goodness, when was this? 2002? I don't know. There was this episode of Sex and the City where Miranda has a deep worry that she'll die alone and be eaten by her cat. And since then, I admit that I have kind of assumed that I will be partially eaten by whichever animal is around me when I meet my untimely demise. And a lot of people apparently really want to know if their pets will eat them after death. And I was astonished to learn, reading your book, that it's not the cats we need to worry about. Why is that?
That's right. I think cats get a kind of a bad rap. but actually, you know, I looked into this pretty deeply and I read a lot of forensic journal scientific papers looking at cases where people had been eaten after they died, or in the world of forensic medicine, one would say, you know, post-mortem scavenging. And it's not all that uncommon. It is scary to think about. It's weird to think about. But it does happen, and it's not necessarily the cats. Not that cats never do it. Of course, you know, cats have been known to take a bite or two. But a lot of the documented cases involve dogs, it turns out. Man's best friend, not always so friendly to us after death.
But at least you're dead. But why is that? Why are cats not as much of a risk as dogs?
You know, we don't really know. It could be actually that our bond with dogs is, you know, strong and special to the extent that they get very upset when an owner dies. You know, some of the cases that have been documented, it's not necessarily always that the dog was left alone for a long time with a dead body and was starving and had to eat something. Actually, it's not that uncommon for a dog to actually consume part of a dead body of its owner, you know, quite quickly. You know, it's not starving. And the reason for that might actually have to do with the fact that the dog and the owner do have a close bond. So, you know, in a sense, it might be because they love us so much. When a dog discovers its owner dead and tries to revive it, what's thought to potentially happen is that the dog may become upset. It's not able to rouse the person, and it might start licking the person's face. Licking might lead to biting when that's not working. And then, you know, once there's blood, then, you know, the dog might start eating. And so, you know, that's kind of a very unpleasant thing to think about happening. But if you think about it from the dog's perspective, it's very scary and traumatic for the dog as well. So in a sense, maybe it's because dogs are man's best friend, that they tend to have that, that kind of traumatized reaction, to the death of an owner. But also, when you think about the feeding patterns in general of cats versus dogs, cats are wonderful predators, and they really want to catch and kill their prey. You know, if you've watched feral cats, for example, you know, they don't tend to scavenge a whole lot, whereas dogs are just better scavengers than cats are. They're a little more willing to, you know, dive in and eat a dead animal, basically. So, you know, that kind of scavenger versus predator thing is probably part of the reason as well.
And I was astonished because it's not just dogs and cats. There's a hamster case.
Oh, yeah, the hamster. That was so sad.
That is sad.
There was a woman who died, and when they found the body, they ended up opening up a drawer, and there was a hamster inside that had gotten loose from its cage, and it had actually chewed up pieces of the woman's dead body and made a nest in a drawer out of little bits of skin and muscle tissue and things. I think the hamster was actually one of the most disturbing ones, just picturing that, not so good.
Yep. Yeah, you know, I was good for the dogs, I was good for the cats, and the hamster. I've now decided, however, that the only pet I will ever have is a fish.
You should be fairly safe. Just don't dive like face down in the water. You should
exactly. You know, the odds are much lower. In your death chapter, there was a lot of really interesting stuff on there about forensic medicine. And some of the cool things that scientists have developed to, you know, figure out things like how much time has elapsed after death, And you know, whodunit, lots of murder stuff. And yeah. I was totally surprised to learn that for a little while, people were plucking out murder victims' eyeballs to try and figure out what they saw before death.
Yes. It didn't work, unfortunately.
Okay. Start there.
Yeah, I wish that were not true. But yeah, there was an idea for a while that perhaps the eye worked sort of like a camera. Like this is back, you know, kind of the early days of photography, and that maybe it would record kind of an image in the eye of the last thing that the person saw when they were alive. And so there were efforts for a while to try to figure out how to capture those images and process these images. I believe they called them optograms. And, you know, it turned out to be a bunch of hazy nothingness, sort of like, you know, when you try to take pictures of ghosts. It didn't really work out so well. But people have had a lot of ideas about ways to try to solve crimes. Not all of them work so well.
And I was also amazed. Not all of these were necessarily crimes, but there was a case, and I didn't know about this until I read your book, that there's been this case of feet in sneakers washing up around Vancouver Island. And it's a lot of feet. I mean, relatively speaking, 15 feet in 12 years.
Yes.
Which is a relatively high number of feet, given that the number of feet you expect to wash up on the beach is zero. And it's just the feet. Why do feet wash up there?
It's amazing. You know, when I found out about the feet, you know, it just was this strange mystery. You know, feet started washing up in the 2000s. And, you know, for a time, it was just like one after the other. And it was like, why feet? And why here? And to track it all down and figure it out, you know, I mean, first, people were thinking, well, there must be some kind of serial killer who's cutting people's feet off or chopping up their bodies into pieces or something like that. Well, so I actually talked to a medical examiner in Vancouver who had examined these feet. It's not a murder. It's not a serial killer. There were no signs that any of the feet had been chopped off, for example. And you end up going into this whole, you have to read the book. you really have to delve into several threads of science to understand why it is that feet in particular are popping off of people's bodies, and what brings them to this particular place. But the short answer is basically, if people end up dying in the water for whatever reason, let's say, you know, just from boating accidents, or they fall, or, you know, this is kind of rocky shores in this area, so it's not that uncommon for hikers to fall and die. So for whatever reason, if someone does die and ends up in the water, in that particular area, they're quite likely to, for their body to sink. They're quite likely to be scavenged by crabs and all kinds of other scavengers that are in the water in that part of the world. And it so happens that feet are pretty easy to actually get off of a body. They don't have there's a lot of just cartilage and ligaments and things holding feet on to the rest of the leg. And so scavengers can tend to go through all of that soft material. And then you've got the fact that when you think about what kind of footwear we wear today, so almost all of the feet that have been found were wearing sneakers. What happens when you take a modern sneaker and throw it into the water these days? It floats, right? Because we have all these wonderful foams that Nike and others have come up with that are really lightweight. So those lightweight sneaker clad feet will then tend to float to the surface. And then you start looking at what are the winds and currents, and where will floating objects tend to go in this area. It's called the Salish Sea, and it's this large kind of bay. And it turns out that it's a wonderful, perfect collector of feet and other stuff that's floating around in the water. So instead of getting carried out to sea, the feet will tend to move towards shore. So that's how you end up with the mystery of the floating feet on the shores of British Columbia.
I love that this is one of those things that, but for design and technology, just wouldn't happen. Like, if we were still designing shoes without foam and air pockets and, mm-hmm. you know, stuff like that in them, you know, or like, you're probably never going to see a foot wash up wearing a Louboutin. Right. You know, because it's not squishy.
Right.
And so it's just this wonderful kind of coming together of gross science and design.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's just that perfect storm. And I love those kinds of science stories where, you know, there's not one answer. There's not really a pat answer to it. It's all of these different things that come together. And, you know, why feet and why now? You know, well, a lot of why now has to do with the fact that we didn't have those foams until, you know, probably the 90s.
And so after you do this whole section on dead bodies, you actually have another section that's about specifically taboos, things that are yes. not okay in our society in general. And I was very interested because you started off with head transplants, mm-hmm. and which is, I never actually thought of it as taboo. I always thought of it as deeply ethically fraught.
It is, and that I also too. Absolutely.
Thought of it as deeply scientifically implausible. Mm-hmm. But there's this guy, his name is Canavero, and he has been trying to do a head transplant for a while. How does he propose to get this done?
Well, he has been working on this for a long time, and as far as I know, still is. He has ended up going to China and has another scientist that he's been working closely with there doing various experiments. So the way that he proposes to get it done, which he is very serious about doing, is more or less what you would imagine. You cut off the head of one body and you attach it to another body. Now, the situations in which this would happen would most likely be a situation where you had a person who had a very serious illness that was killing them, but their mind was intact, right? And you would take that person's head and put it onto a healthy body. Now, the healthy body would most likely be that of a brain dead person, someone who had been in, you know, perhaps an accident or something where the person's body is in good shape, but their brain is not functioning. So that's the idea, is to basically meld together the two healthy parts into one person. Surprisingly, the big challenge of this isn't necessarily hooking up all of the plumbing. There have been experiments, not just by Canavero, but going back into history, of scientists who have tried variations on this in experiments with animals with some measure of success. The hard part isn't necessarily getting the blood vessels hooked up and so forth. It's the neurosurgery part. It's, you know, can you basically reconnect the spinal cord? Is there any chance at all that the person is not just paralyzed from the neck down? Canavero thinks that it is possible to do that. That is very controversial. But one more realistic thing that might come out of this work is looking at repairing spinal cord injuries. And there has been in recent years some pretty amazing success where you've, you know, we've seen videos, for example, of rats whose spinal cords were severed and then have been reconnected and they regained some motor function, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. So essentially what Canavero has proposed doing is taking those kinds of real world surgeries that have been done and applying them to a whole body kind of transplant. Whether I think that is ever going to happen, I don't know. But I do think that it's important that we think about whether that might be okay to do. It is pushing a lot of, you know, body taboos and taboos around death to think about the ethics of this. You know, is it okay to, you know, to use someone who has maybe donated their body to science? They might be thinking that their organs are going to be harvested. If they're brain dead, they're probably not thinking that somebody else is going to have their entire body, you know, attached to their head. So there are just a whole range of ethical questions that come up and a lot of things that are taboo and that, you know, frankly, make just people very uncomfortable. We may just not be willing to go there. But I can tell you that, you know, Canavero is pretty serious about wanting to go there. And he's probably not going to be the only one. If he's come up with the idea, then even if he doesn't manage to do it, this is probably an idea that will come back in the future.
I will note that Canavero did do a full head transplant from one person to another. Nobody died.
Correct.
And that's great because both people were dead to begin with.
Yes.
He literally swapped heads on cadavers. When you talk about, for example, rats achieving, you know, mobility following spinal cord severance and like the potential to help spinal cord injury or neurodegenerative diseases with this kind of research, like that's one thing. I guess one of the things that kind of I think is kind of I wouldn't say taboo, but uncomfortable about Canavero's head transplant idea is that it's kind of showy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's going that extra mile. This isn't, I'm going to try and, you know, help people with spinal cord injury, or I'm going to try and help people with neurodegenerative diseases. He's like, no, I'm going to Frankenstein this.
Yeah. And what he's really about is radical human life extension, right? I mean, his ultimate goal in this is not just to help people with spinal cord injuries and so forth, although he does do research on that and thinks it's important, but ultimately his bigger goal is much more about the idea that perhaps one day we can greatly extend our own lives, even if we're not, you know, sick and dying of some, you know, disease like the person who he proposed doing the head transplant surgery with originally, who had a severe muscle wasting disease. But ultimately, Canavero is interested in the idea that perhaps we could even, you know, harvest, we could basically clone brainless bodies and then, you know, transplant our brains into them so that you get to have like extra lifetimes, you know, when your brain can just go into a fresh body. So it all sounds kind of crazy, and that's a lot of like probably pretty pie in the sky kind of stuff. But I think it's very interesting to think about what would we be willing to do to essentially live forever? Would you be willing to have your brain transplanted into another body if it meant that you could live another lifetime? That is a question that is not always so easy to answer.
It's interesting because many things that are taboo in a lot of cultures are associated with death. You know, like murder, like cannibalism, all those kind of necrophilia associated with death.
Yes.
And yet life extension is not taboo, even if you try to do taboo things to get there.
Right. I think the idea of life extension is not taboo. But when you start getting into things that feel to some people like desecrating a dead body, essentially, then it starts to become taboo. And, you know, what about the idea of cloning a human body that doesn't have a brain so that you can use it to put your own brain into? I mean, that starts to feel like there's something more deeply or morally wrong, repugnant in a way that gets into that kind of realm of taboo, that goes beyond what we're used to thinking about when we think about medicine as, you know, a good thing. We think of medicine as something that makes people healthier, makes them live longer, you know. So we have to keep in mind that that other transplants have been considered taboo as well. You know, it wasn't that long ago that people were pretty freaked out by the idea of heart transplants. In Japan, they were taboo until really very recently, because a person wasn't considered to be truly dead until their heart stopped beating. And so keeping someone's heart beating so that it could be transplanted into another person, when you took that heart out, it was considered like murder. Basically, you'd be killing that person by taking the heart out, even though by Western science standards, the person may have already been dead. So there were just a lot of issues. You know, a lot of what's taboo or not taboo is really just, is cultural. It depends how we view it and what we think is okay, not okay. And it gets into a lot of what we think is disgusting or not.
Did you ever, did you talk to any like ethicists about some of these taboo subjects? You had a whole bunch in the book, including necrophilia, cannibalism, etc., murder. Did you talk to ethicists about these taboos?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to people who've thought about the ethics of a number of these things. For example, like necrophilia, you talked about. That's one where ethicists have thought about it. It's one of those, you know, necrophilia is feels like one of the most obvious taboos. Like, that's just taboo everywhere, every culture. Nobody thinks necrophilia is okay. You want to start to think about why that is, you know, and that gets into our taboos around death and some things that make sense. You know, it's not a good idea for people to be having sex or close contact with dead bodies. Dead bodies are, you know, full of bacteria. It's very dangerous. It's not a good idea. It's a great way to spread disease. So it makes a lot of sense that cultures around the world have prohibited that and made that taboo. But there is certainly, you know, cultural context for what is taboo, what isn't taboo. You know, it tends to overlap a lot with the things that we find disgusting. And there are a lot of commonalities to what people find disgusting around the world. This tends to be the same kinds of things about death, things about sex, things about bodily functions, and things about food and eating. So those tend to be the kinds of areas that we have a lot of disgusts around. Those also tend to be the kind of things that we have taboos around. Taboos just being things that we consider to be, forbidden and to have this kind of extra layer of being wrong, basically, that there's a moral quality to a taboo on top of it being often considered something that's disgusting or bad to do. So, yeah. So in the end, you know, there's a lot of fluidity around what's considered to be taboo by different cultures, but there are a lot of commonalities, just like there are for what's disgusting.
So I did want to discuss one other taboo topic because it's mildly amusing to me. Cannibalism.
I'm glad you find cannibalism funny.
So here's the thing. I just love that you wrote about how a scientist decided to figure out how many calories a human had in it.
Yeah, I mean, hasn't everyone wondered?
And I was actually wondering, you don't really cover this in the book. How did he do this? Like, did he put a human body in a bomb calorimeter? Like, how did he make this calculation?
I wish. I wish. No, he actually, but a lot of people have more or less done that for different parts of the body. So we know a lot about, you know, the qualities of and protein content and carbohydrate content, all of those kinds of things for a lot of different parts of the body. So he basically spent a lot of time pulling together a whole lot of data from various sources in order to come up with an estimate of the total number of calories that would be in a human body and how those would be distributed around the body. So hint, hint, should one ever need to resort to cannibalism in order to survive, probably go for the thigh muscles first. Very nice, calorie rich.
Which is, you know, I feel like that's kind of self-evident.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, you know, those nice meaty thighs, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
So I was actually wondering, like, how many calories?
So the number of calories in a 145-pound human turns out to be about 32,000 calories in the skeletal muscle alone. And if you start looking at the organs, you know, there's about 2,500 calories in the liver, for example, but about 13,000 calories in that thigh meat. So that's why you want to go for that first.
And did he address the question as to whether or not we are tough and gamey or succulent?
He did not try any cannibalism himself, I can tell you that. But he did talk to some people who, you know, and looked at reports from people who had, for various reasons, engaged in cannibalism. Some people tend to say that humans are pretty tasty. You know, we were pretty high in fat content, so I would imagine that a human doesn't taste too bad. The scientist told me that some people had described people as tasting roughly like pork. And he said that, in fact, that made it kind of hard for him to eat bacon for a while.
Agree.
Yeah.
So I actually have to say, when I read this section, I was kind of insulted because I'm just kind of insulted that we're not more nutritionally dense. Like, I yeah. want us to be better food, which is not great. Like, I yeah, shouldn't yeah. want that.
Right. A deer is better food, really. Like, so you know, given the choice.
Why are we bad food?
Yeah. Well, you know, we fill our bodies with junk. What can I say? but
we also
yeah.
don't have as much stuff on us. We don't have as much like flesh on, like, compared to a deer. Is it just?
Yeah. I mean, just the way I think we're relatively low, you know, muscle mass compared to some, you know, other mammals that would be good prey. You know, one thing to take comfort in is that, you know, you don't necessarily want to be anyone's tastiest prey. Maybe it's good for us that we turn out not to be the most calorie-rich option on anyone's menu.
Do not want to be the chicken or the cow of.
That's right.
That's fair. I mean, I'm very competitive, but maybe I'm okay giving up that fight.
I think let's give that one up.
Now, another thing that in Western culture is considered very taboo, and more particularly something that you made me promise we would talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Is anything that women experience below the neck.
Correct.
And in particular, Men have finally, a fanfare of some kind. Men have finally discovered the clitoris.
Yes.
After Columbus discovered America, and note, I'm going to go ahead and say discovered was in very hefty, sarcastic air quotes there.
Absolutely. I mean, what's amazing to me when I started looking into the history of female anatomy textbooks and so forth was that male scientists have discovered the clitoris not once, not twice, but several times over the years. You know, many people have laid claim to this organ. They seem not to get the message very quickly. So
I'm going to keep all of my jokes to myself.
Yeah,
they're
I know.
All in here. They're all in here.
I know. It really is amazing. But you know, way back in 1559, you know, Realdus Columbus, an Italian scientist, he described the clitoris in great detail in his anatomical book. And not to be outdone, you know, he ended up in a battle with Gabriel Fallopia of Fallopian tube fame, who claimed that no, actually he discovered the clitoris. And they were describing what it did. And none of them really had much of a clue. But they did discover at least that there was a sexual function. Earlier, scientists had ascribed it urinary functions. Wrong. That's not what it's for. So it actually ended up being described and redescribed, put in textbooks, taken out of textbooks, you know, all kinds of crazy things. Really, it wasn't until the 1990s when we had a really good, complete description of the entire clitoral structure and all of the nerves and blood vessels that supply it. And that came from a female urologist who did the hard work of actually mapping everything out and showing the full scale and nerve endings and everything that make up the clitoris.
I just love that the two men who competed for this were very angry at each other about who had discovered it first, because the only thing more important than women's sexual function is men's scientific credit.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Because of course.
Yes. And in fact, you know, Fallopia wrote in his book in the 16th century, he wrote, "If others have spoken of it," referring to the clitoris, "know that they have taken it from me or my students." He was very snippy about the whole thing. You know, everyone wanted to lay claim to a new discovery. And the female body, of course, fought over more than any other territory on Earth.
And you promised me a quote about the clitoris that got cut because it was too racy.
That's right.
For
yes.
The book. I demand to hear it. What is
yes.
it?
So this is a quote from Realdus Columbus from his book in 1559, De Re Anatomica. He described the clitoris in this book as a certain small part located above the opening of the urethra that was, quote, "the principal seat of women's enjoyment and intercourse, so that if you not only rub it with your penis, but even touch it with your little finger, the pleasure causes their seed to flow forth in all directions, swifter than the wind, even if they don't want it to."
Columbus should have taken up romance novel writing. He had a few.
Yes. I agree. I think it's a wonderful quote. I mean, I had so many questions after I read that. What is he talking about with the seed, and why is it happening even if they don't want it to? A lot of questions left unanswered there.
A lot of questions about his scientific methods there. Definitely.
Yeah, Yeah, I have to imagine him inflicting orgasms on women, you know, left and right after, you know, he made his wonderful discovery of the clitoris.
Well, at least somebody got something out of it.
That's right.
So I also wanted to talk about another, like, closely related taboo, women experiencing things below the neck. Mm-hmm. Menstruation is seriously taboo. There are cultures that exile women to special huts. There are cultures that keep women out of the kitchen while they are menstruating, which has to involve a lot of kitchenless time, which might be a break, actually. That might be nice. And certainly, it's something that even in the West, we have a rough time with. Like, I remember every time you see a commercial for a women's product, the liquid they always pour on the pad or tampon is blue.
Yeah.
Because they don't want it to look like blood. Because that's just too much.
Because that would be gross. Because that would be gross. Yeah.
And I was wondering, why is this? Because this is something that roughly half the population experiences at some point in their life.
Absolutely.
And yet it is incredibly taboo. Why?
Well, let me drag my soapbox over here and get up on top of it, because I have a lot to say about menstruation. Yeah. In fact, that's one of my favorite topics. I've been working on a story for National Geographic all about menstruation and periods and how things are changing around these taboos around the world when it comes to menstruation. It's something that I think is really important and really timely. You know, as for why is it taboo? Why do we have all these hangups about it? Okay, well, I guess we can say that I personally, I don't think periods are gross, but I will admit that, okay, there's some goriness involved, right? Anyone who's had a period will probably agree with me there. Sometimes it can get pretty gory. So we're dealing with body fluids and blood in particular. That's something that people are squeamish about, right? And then we're dealing with sex and reproduction, another thing that people are uncomfortable with. And it's all happening in a female body, which is, of course, the most taboo territory. So a lot of things come together to make periods one of those things that people just are not comfortable with, don't want to talk about, want to pretend is not happening. But you're right. They absolutely are happening. They're not anything to be embarrassed about. And I think people are starting to come around to that. By the way, one thing that I have really gotten on the soapbox about in researching the story that I've been working on about menstruation is that we tend to think of, we as Westerners, as Americans, as Europeans, we tend to think of stigma and taboo around menstruation as being something that happens in other societies, in other cultures, someplace far away, someplace where women are relegated to a menstrual hut when they're on their period, that kind of thing. But I would argue that Western culture did a wonderful job of creating and furthering stigma and taboo about menstruation and the menstrual cycle. It's not something that is just a problem somewhere else. We all have carried those taboos with us. You know, and I think that it is changing, but it has been, you know, a long, difficult battle to just get women access to adequate hygiene, to allow, you know, women and girls to even talk about their period without being stigmatized. So, you know, I would just caution that, you know, it's not just places elsewhere. Really, it's something that we as Westerners have done a great job of making taboo and of making women feel bad about. right down to that stupid blue liquid that they pour on pads and commercials. You know, it was just very recently, I think it was last week, that I said to my husband, oh my gosh, that commercial has pink fluid. There was one commercial, I can't remember what brand it was for now, but they poured pink fluid onto a
pad.
I was amazed. I was amazed. It's a breakthrough, you know. But it's ridiculous that we're still at the point where that's something that women have to be embarrassed about, and that we understand so poorly. You know, there are millions of women around the world suffering from menstrual disorders like endometriosis and polycystic ovarian syndrome that are really underfunded, understudied, that we don't have treatments for, that we barely diagnose. You know, in the case of endometriosis, it's diagnosed through surgery. And that's just, you know, in my mind, pretty unacceptable. We need to do better. We need to understand more about women's bodies and how they work and the ways that they actually affect us. And no, it's not all just about PMS making us crazy. So, you know, we have so many stigmas and so many ways that we treat women poorly around their periods that I think we don't even think about it. You know, we make PMS jokes. We don't even think about the fact that we're furthering stigma, just like someone is if they require their wife not to work in the kitchen during their period. It all comes from the same place.
And I was really struck. It's kind of funny to move from menstruation to this, but I was struck at the end of the book when you noted that many people think because you write about gross stuff, mm-hmm. you write for kids.
Yes.
And this is funny because I write for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And people assume the opposite of me. They assume that I must write about gross stuff, which, to be fair, I do with great relish. But
yes.
I also write about climate change and quantum physics. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, why do you think that the gory details of life are so closely associated with kids in people's minds?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it really is one of the first questions that people tend to ask me when I tell them about my book or about the kinds of things that I like to write about. They say, oh, do you write for kids? Or would your book be good for my 12-year-old boy? And I have to say, well, you know, I didn't set out to write a children's book. I don't think Gory Details is a children's book. It's definitely geared toward grownups. But grownups like gross stuff too. That's the secret. You know, we think of kids as liking gross stuff. And then we act like, well, we're supposed to grow out of that. And when we grow up, we're supposed to lose interest in all of those, you know, gory details and gross things. We think that only kids are interested in body functions and, you know, in poop. But that's not really true. You know, we're all interested in our bodies. We're interested in death. We're interested in sex. We're interested in all of the same kind of things that fascinate kids. We're just socialized not to talk about those kinds of things at dinner parties. And I really wanted to write a book that was gross stuff for grownups because, you know, there are lots of books out there that are about farts and poop and are geared toward kids. And that's great. And it's good fun. And it's a great way for kids to learn about science. But I don't think that the learning has to stop when you hit puberty, you know, I mean, I think grownups also, can learn a lot about science through gross stuff. And for us, you know, sometimes it's maybe more about facing our fears. You know, for me, definitely when I write about things that are gross or scary or creepy, I find that I'm a little less scared of them, you know, once I understand them. And it's a little easier to talk about things, you know, like death or disease that sometimes we need to talk about. you know, it's okay to talk about those things. And so I hope that by writing a book like Gory Details, I might make it a little easier for some people to talk about those things and to realize it's okay to be interested in them.
I think that's your tagline right there. Erica Engelhaupt, adults need poop books too.
Yes, we do.
And, you know, there's so much in this book. There's earwax and penguins doing terrible things and yes. maggots. And I mean,
so many maggots,
lots of maggots, dead rats, many dead rats.
Yes.
And how did you pick which stories to include and which to leave out?
Oh, it was not easy. I mean, I went through the backlog of the blog and all of the stories that I had. And one thing I did was I started looking for themes. Which was fascinating to me to see, like, I mean, I hadn't necessarily occurred to me before that I tended to write about the disgust and taboos, for example, but I realized a lot of my work kind of fit into those categories. So I picked things that fit in well with those categories that I personally thought were interesting and fairly evergreen. And then I started thinking about what else I wanted to say on those topics. So I wrote a lot of new material for the book as well. I'd say about, in terms of the word count of the book, it's more than half of it is new material that wasn't in the blog, because I really expanded and updated a lot of the existing blog posts and then wrote a lot of new stuff from scratch, got to do some wonderful travel and see lots of fun things in the course of doing the research for the book. So I need to write another one so that I can go more places and do more things, because it was such a blast going and seeing a maggot farm in Texas, going and actually getting to find and see the face mites that live in my own face. I mean, how many people get to have that experience?
I'm dying to see my own face mites. I'm not going to lie. I really, really want to see one.
It's cool. And to see, you know, to see one and know that it came out of you. So few people get the opportunity to see what lives in their own face. I mean, you know, aren't you curious?
I'm dying to see like something shaped like my pore.
Yeah.
That's really like the fact that they're exactly shaped like the pores in your skin just blows my mind. I love it.
And they just pretty much live their whole life stuck in a pore in your face, you know? Yeah. It turns out that I have plenty of face mites, so it wasn't that hard to find them. But, you know, it makes me feel better that it turns out pretty much all of us have them.
And you mentioned that you kind of went through the blog and you looked for broad themes. Did you try to create kind of like an overall message, an overall kind of narrative arc to the book?
Yes. And I don't know whether people will, hopefully it will all just be so fluid that you don't even necessarily realize that by the time you get to the end of the book, you've gotten kind of a larger message through the whole thing. But everything that I was talking about earlier about, you know, disgust and how that ties together so much of the things that scare us, gross us out, freak us out, you know, that's a really important theme, I think, in the book. And getting people to face some of these uncomfortable topics and look at them in depth and see that they're actually not that scary or not that gross. They're actually pretty interesting by the time you start learning about them. You know, I think that kind of builds as you learn, you know, as we think about disgust earlier in the book and then go through things that are taboo and then go through some examples that are pretty relatable in terms of our own bodies and minds. I think by the end, it's like, okay, I'm not so weird for having a little bit of morbid curiosity or for liking to, you know, watch. I like watching those CSI shows. I will admit it, even though I know they get a lot of science wrong. You know, I'm interested in that kind of stuff. I like forensic science. I think a lot of other people are interested in things like that too. And it's okay. It doesn't mean you're weird or morbid or creepy. Because you are interested in those kinds of things, it's perfectly fine. So, you know, I think by the end of the book, hopefully people feel a little more comfortable with themselves and a little more comfortable talking about things that otherwise they wouldn't be.
And last question, you mentioned you found a necklace in that pile of, you know, dentist office stuff that was dumped on your doorstep, and you kept all the molds of the teeth. Do you still have the teeth?
I think there's probably got to be at least one of those molds in my mom's attic. I have not been able to get up there and look through old boxes to see if I can find any of them. I hung on to those for a pretty long time, so I'm hoping there's still one around somewhere. Maybe after the pandemic, I'll be able to, you know, paw through my parents' stuff and find one. In the meantime, I do have a little necklace that I found in a jewelry box in the pile of trash. You know, it's one of those little treasures amidst the stuff that nobody else wanted to dig through.
Well, honestly, I could talk with you about all this stuff for ages, but listeners are just going to have to get the book. Erica, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about Erica Engelhaupt and her book, Gory Details, Adventures in the Dark Side of Science, we've got links for you at scienceforthepeople.ca. And there's more than that on our website. There's links to subscribe, which you should do. There's links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and tell us what you like or don't like about the show. There's even a link to our Patreon page where you can help us out, if you're so inclined, with a monthly donation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener-supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.